analytically about some of these self-employed domestics and other informal sector people who have informal contracts, not formal, to think about them in the contemporary period. I've tried to look at them in the developing context of the past, but those employments are not gone. They're in transition, and I think we need to talk about them and bring them home in through the lens of the educated middle class that so many people are interested in. So I have two other questions, and one for Gay, which is then how maybe what would be the parallel in the South Africa case about relationships between those insecure middle classes? Who's on the other end of that relationship, even if it's not, whether it's a domestic or something else? And then the third thing that I thought, just to throw another political science answer, the scientists that I think both of you could help us think about, I couldn't help but think about the work of Ira Katznelson, who looks at the relationship between home and work, since that's what you brought up, Rocca. And then, Gay, you mentioned about Black middle class is so worried about where they're going to have to be physically, where their home will be. It's not just that they're losing their job. They are being, their work life is connected to their home life. And I'm wondering whether we need to put that on the analytic table here to think about what are the implications of these two stories for politics, because that's what Ira was talking about. The homework relationship explains American exceptionalism, a certain type of liberal politics as opposed to class politics. So maybe there you could take it one step further on the politics from your examples.
Okay, Tony.
Thank you so much. I have questions for both panelists, Rebecca and Gay. But I suppose just building maybe on this question, this idea of what I found really fascinating in both talks was the idea that the middle class is arriving in certain ways, and there's this demonstrative effect going on, that you signal. There's a strong signaling component of the middle class, and certainly in the Middle East, and in India, in South Africa. And so what fascinates me often is why? Why is it so important to kind of guard the boundaries of now we're in the middle class, therefore we have to dress, eat, act, socialize in these ways? I mean, certainly there are stereotypes enormously linked to what middle class means and how you live within that middle class, and what are the implications then for the type of models or political consequences of middle class, let's say, mobilization efforts and whatnot? Because what's going on, it appears, is that at least to demonstrate your middle class, you have to have the resources, you have to have wealth or assets, but it doesn't say anything about the means of production, it doesn't say anything about the structure of the society and how you're deriving that wealth. So perhaps you could be middle class in some context and that not going to mean the same in other contexts, but I find it very curious that you do have this demonstrative effect in these more developing societies. And then about the culture of servitude, if you may. I'm not sure how it works in India, but one of the things that's, I think, happening in the Middle East, if you're middle class, I mean, that's why it's probably much easier to be a working woman, a working mother in the Middle East than it is in the United States, is that you're going to have a nanny and a cook and a maid and the whole barrage. But what's happened there is that the discourse on rights has been compromised, in my opinion, right? Because if you're not, this is really domestic enslavement. They bring in these workers from South Asia, $100 a month, and they're just stuck with you for an entire year. To justify that, to rationalize that this is acceptable, you really have to kind of relax the assumptions about human rights and workers' rights and whatnot, and is the middle class really now, in this sense, then a force of anti-democratization and anti-liberal values as well?
Well, there's a lot there. we have time, because I think we have until 2:45. So take 10-ish minutes or so.
I don't know in what order I'm going to take them, and I might sort of randomly think of other things as I go along. But I actually want to start with something you just said about it enabling middle-class women in the Middle East to go out and work. One of the things that I find particularly ironic is India is a country with very low women's labor force participation, 11% urban labor force participation of women even today. So when we talk about paid domestic work in say the US or Europe, it's very much the assumption of this, the occupation has returned because middle-class women are leaving the home and they need other people to take their place in the home in order to be able to go out and have careers. But, you know, the case that I've looked at, when you're actually looking at just 11% of women working, then the hiring of servants is far more a class marker than it is a certain kind of functional need. But it's also defined as a need there, but it really sort of makes us think about what need means. So I just wanted to throw that out. I'm going to relate your question again to Devesh's question about do the Communist Party functionaries have servants? And the answer is, of course, they have servants. And it's the book that I've written is called Cultures of Servitude, and it means that actually it's something that is about the private sphere, but it spills over into relationships in the office, how you treat people in hierarchies, so it's sort of the book really focuses on the private sphere, but it's very much about how it spills over. And I think that communist functionaries also treat people lower than them in their peons, etc., in very similar sort of servile sorts of with expectations of servility in that sense. I think the assumption of the relaxation of rights in the home is a really searing and important remark. I think this is indeed the problem. And this is indeed the problem that I think is something that troubles me about a full democratization of politics. And it began to trouble me. It's something I went into the field with and it got sort of heightened. It's not as much in the book as it should be, really, but it got heightened because when I finished my first book, which was on the women's movement in India, that's when I realized all the activists actually had servants. Everybody I had talked to could not have done their work without servants, right? So, but not only that, I was also aware of the history of the women's movement here in the US and in Europe. And the second wave of women's movements really had, as one of its core issues, a struggle over domestic labor here. Right? Who was to do the domestic labor? You know, husband or wife, you know, wages for housework, you know, old Marxist feminist debates. But it was really very central. The struggle over domestic division of labor was very central to US and UK in particular, the second wave feminist movement. And as I studied the women's movement in India and I looked at all of them, all of the servants that the activists had, it became very clear to me that the fact that the institution existed, or that so many people had servants, not only meant that they could be freed up to go out to work, but it also meant that the domestic division of labor never appeared as a political issue. It never got politicized in India because neither the husband nor the wife were doing the labor. So it wasn't actually a site of struggle. So it occurred to me that this institution, so private, actually has spillover effects in shaping what becomes the public the public agenda. Back to Devesh, the issue of why do I call it servant, right? So I thought about this for months, whether I was going to use the word servant or not, because within India, in colloquial language, it is in Bengal, chakor, in Hindi, naukar. The translation is servant. There is now an attempt to say, I don't know what it is in Hindi, in Bengal, it's kajer lok, which is closer to domestic worker, right? It's beginning to change, but we think it's very much a culture in transition, and the ways in which people talk about domestic workers is within certain assumptions that clearly stem from feudalism, which is why we actually kept the word servant. Overcompensation in consumption, that's very, very marked with the servants' children. No doubt about it, they have, when servants are torn between paying for their children's education, and the only way the children can actually be educated is through, or to pass, or to do well not to be educated, to actually do well enough to get anywhere, is if, within the Indian context, they have private tutors, right? Because the entire middle class has private tutors. You know, school hardly functions anymore. The entire middle class has private tutors. So any extra money that the servants make goes in for the private tutors for their kids, or, like, you know, they will ask their employer to, will you, instead of giving me a bonus, will you pay for a private tutor for my daughter this year? That. So all the extra money goes in either that or in clothing. And that's the, especially with the daughters. So it's absolutely, there's a lot of, there's certain sorts of things that servants do to ensure, and this is the main difference, I would say, between the older generation of servants and this one. This generation of servants will not have children who become servants. Of that, I'm fairly assured. They, you know, some of them have, between the time I began working and on the project and now, some of them have joined call centers. So I'm not one of those who just says, oh, call centers, you know. I wish they'd never gone to India. I actually see that the father is earning 1,000 rupees a month and the daughter is earning 15,000 rupees a month. That's 15 times more than the father at age, you know, 21. So there is, that's a huge sort of site of upward mobility. Globalization. The returned migrants, these aren't individual relationships, right? These are social relationships. So people who return migrants grew up in India, went abroad, and then they go back. And they get reinserted into the particular patterns that already exist. Some of them actually go back so that they can have servants with more ease. They have children who are growing up. It's just getting too much to handle. Especially if the woman wants to have a flourishing career, that's actually part of the reason they go back. And they may or may not treat the servants any better. There's no evidence that they do, let's say. And Patrick, yes, absolutely. It's very much about the rational modern projection and practices of exclusion. I did not ultimately end up studying one of the things that I thought would form a focus of my study, which is children. Tell me why. You know why? I didn't get human subjects clearance. It's just one of those things that just kills me. They would not allow me to study children, right? But what I did do is, but we talk a lot to, because I was so interested in and so convinced that it's the first site. The home is the first site. There's a whole lot of unconscious learning. So when I talked to employers and I would talk to them about awareness, right? And stories about, you know, thinking that the servant is your friend and then suddenly realizing he is actually not. Talking about, you know, just an anecdote about somebody saying we were very close. We even ate together. He was a child servant and she was a child. They were the same age. They used to play together, eat together. And one night the child was cold, this boy. And he came into bed with her. And he got into bed with her and to use the blanket, you know. And the next day he was fired, right? And saying that she was sad to see him go, but it's only when I was talking to her in this interview context that she realized why he was fired, right? And so those sorts of unconscious learnings, or people now, adults, actually crying as they told me they remembered somebody giving them candy and they said, distribute it to all your friends. And there were all these children, including servant children. And they distributed to everybody, just skipped over the servant children. But now recalling and thinking about the times when, how did they learn that this child was not just a child like them, but was to be skipped over when it came to the distribution of candy. So those sorts of things, which are indeed the sort of unconscious learning, or some of it is conscious teaching, some of it is just modeling. So those are the processes that I could not observe, but only got at through asking the adults. And I'll take one more minute to answer domestics middle class. No, I think domestics aren't middle class, because the middle class wouldn't exist if domestics were middle class. I mean, The middle class needs the domestics not to be middle class in order for them to be middle class. It's part of the creation of middle class identity is having an other, which is in the home, which is the servant. So you actually, it's not a possibility. But one of the things you reminded me of in terms of the contract is, I think that our assumption of the trajectory of labor is the feudalism to capitalism assumption, which is from the field to the factory, from personalistic and patronage labor, client relationships to wage contract, right? But that's the field to factory model. But like, you know, you have Dipesh Chakravarti who sort of calls for provincializing Europe, I sometimes think we should provincialize the factory. The factory is not the site of labor, it's a site of labor. And there's no reason to assume that the home or a sweatshop or an office even should have exactly the same relationships of labor, there will be a different sort of relationship. And I would say that for the home, and I'm just beginning to think about this actually, it's not going to follow the pure personal to the pure contract. It's going to be, and when I say it's an unfinished contract, I mean it is a permanently unfinished contract. Because the home is a site of the personal, is a site of emotion. It's very difficult for to have a pure contract, pure impersonal relationship in the home. But it's just to think about what relations of labor of the home would look like, even as if you say, how do you account for change? I don't want to say that there's no change. There is change, but it doesn't have to follow change the way the change goes from field to factory.
So these are great questions, and I'm going to have to figure out some of them I don't have an answer to. But Patrick, in terms of the division within the middle class, so the public sector workers' salaries in South Africa really vary. So teachers and lower level people in the bureaucracies don't earn that much. People in the director or above level actually earn very well and have much higher salaries. But all of them depend on public policy decisions. And it seems to me that one of the really complicated things facing the ANC, is, especially because there's going to be a huge economic collapse because commodity prices have fallen so drastically in the last year, they're facing a really tough set of decisions about salary structures for the public sector workers. I don't know how that's going to play out, but I think when so many members of the African elite now depend on public sector wages, raising public sector wages in the context of economic collapse is going to be really difficult. I don't think they've been as good at keeping up with inflation as you seem to think that they have for public sector wages, but I think that's going to be even more fraught. The other part of the policy division that I think is maybe even more fraught is I think there's been a real difficulty for the ANC in thinking about how to sustain services to the formerly white neighborhoods. Since most upper-class blacks now live in formerly white neighborhoods, it's very hard when you're thinking about public expenditures to think about favoring formerly white neighborhoods when you have so many people out in the townships who are poor. And yet services clearly matter for those neighborhoods sustaining their character. I think it's one of the reasons you're seeing more and more privatization of services so that people can keep those services up without having to go through the public policy debate. But it is not, this is very problematic, I think. I don't think people are voting for COPE. I think COPE got a very small vote because in the end, I think who COPE was trying to appeal to was the black middle class. And I think precisely for the reasons that Diane said, the Mexican middle class is never, the political parties, conservative middle class parties always say they speak for the middle class, but they're actually following policies that help the elite. Populist parties have often claimed to speak for the poor but actually protected the middle class. It's not clear which is what I think COPE would have done, but COPE didn't go anywhere. So we still have the ANC, and the question is what the ANC is going to do. I think it's likely to speak to the poor and then privatize so that its public functions will be for the poor, but they'll allow middle class neighborhoods to protect themselves, which I don't think this is a healthy in terms of development strategies in the long run, I think this is not a good scenario, but it's very fraught. I think actually that last part links to your question about labor contracts. Part of what's happened to the state over the last 15 years is the increasing privatization, or more and more stuff has been subcontracted, and so more and more of these professionals who work for the state have been contracting to the state. So people who are in public service leave the public service and then do exactly the same thing for the ministry, but under contract for much more money, and it's incredibly expensive, but it's also very, very insecure, and people are constantly worrying about their next contract, which is why this threat of corruption becomes so real, because if you depend on getting the next contract, then you're willing to pay a little extra to get that contract. It's very dangerous. I mean, it's a hollowing out of the state, which I think is linked to these insecurities that we need to think about.
Okay, great. So why don't we take another round of questions? Ethel?
That was a great panel. Thank you, both of you. Raka, I really enjoyed that presentation. Just trying to get a handle on how much I can extrapolate from the micro understandings you have very skillfully brought to us, how much we can extrapolate into the public sphere. You claim that this is sort of a public sphere. We should think of it as a sphere which is not that different than the political sphere, or sort of part of it, or it has ramifications. We don't want to claim that this is a private sphere. And so I'm trying to figure out what exactly is the link between what goes on inside the home and what goes on outside. And here's my confusion. I think the story you're telling of narrowing social distance between domestics and the middle class is a story which fits with our understanding of what's happening broadly in India in terms of politics and dignity. Mm-hmm. Caste distances are narrowing. Even in village society, the middle castes don't like the lowest caste walking with their head straight up and, you know, beat them up and this and that. So we know that when it comes to social distances, the gap has been narrowing, and those at the top don't like it. So that part you've captured very nicely in the domestic story, because it's consistent with the broader story. But what we also know is that economic distances are growing. So economic inequalities are widening, whereas social distances are narrowing. Mm-hmm. All right? Mm-hmm. And so this aspect of economic inequalities growing is not being captured by your story. So I would hesitate to extrapolate from the domestic story into the public realm, because I think the same middle class which is feeling anxious at home is feeling quite empowered in the public realm. And so there remains a distinction between what happens in some sphere, whatever you want to call it, you know, whether it's a domestic sphere or it's a, you know, politics of dignity as opposed to politics of wealth and economic inequality. But there are two types of things that are happening simultaneously, and they're moving in different directions. And so I'm trying to get a handle on that, how to make sense of that. So if you can think out loud about that,
sure. That would be helpful. Okay. Jagorsh and then Noha.
This is, if we can have a discussion, so, you know, not only on that line, but also I just want to move on, because I think this is a very, very important point in terms of thinking about class distinctions and what is really crucial in sort of understanding of, you know, how hierarchies and stratifications are built. You know, it seems to me that one of the major problems in thinking in terms of income and income inequalities is that income is not visible, right? So there are strategies of showing your social position which have very little to do with income. And the modern society, what it creates, creates tools for doing this. For example, loans, credit cards, other things allow you to look like someone who makes a lot of money, but in fact you don't. Right? So, but what is visible is consumption, right? What is visible is taste. And I think from that point of view, I think Raka has a point that you know, in this cultural context, those invisible income differentials are not really sort of coming to play a major role in ways people think about other people.
I just have a two-hand, which is this kind of point which you made there, this conversation. I mean, this work in sort of ECB which we're doing, is, I mean, that's absolutely the question that's coming out, is how do you make sense of the fact that, you know, if income inequalities are growing, but social inequality, that's the term, or narrowing of social, if that is declining, and everything that at least R&D got a sample of, so 20,000 households, it's really very much based on evidence. Then how do you, how do you add up the two? I mean, in some ways, is it going to be a judgment on what weights you put to what? And you could argue that over time, you worry about income inequalities, then translating into certain stratifications of political inequality. Capture parts, but at least in the state where we are doing, Dalits, which is the lowest class, have also got political parts. It's not the case that even if income inequalities are growing, that they're losing out on political parts.
That's just like the United States.
Yes, exactly.
I mean,
Exactly right. And so, how do you, and that's one thing that's grappling with, how do you add up this?
I have one more two-finger here.
I think she had a question.
Just one more add-on to this one.
Oh, add-on to
this
one.
Then move on
to
the next. This is based on this conversation, but I think what Atul says, on the one hand, that inequalities are increasing, and Rob is saying, well, social distance is decreasing, but, so I mean, going back to the point of this all means how the middle class is portrayed, what it, in the boundaries of the middle class, right? So much of it is about conspicuous consumption, that even though the inequalities are increasing, I mean, what does it take to be a middle-class person in this day and age, right? If you have a cell phone, talk on the cell phone. I mean, there's this great story, it's always about people are always talking on the cell phones even if they don't have the card to charge the cell phone, because it signals people, look, I'm the only one in the class, I'm important. And so the idea is that in this era of globalization, it's basically like this normative, everybody wants to be part of the middle class, and yet the middle class is this now this elusive category of how you signal to people that you are not of the equal or the lower status. So I think that they could be, it could be happening simultaneously based on the location in the developing world.
No, you're right. As I was saying, I resolved the problem in my own head. In a sense, it's the classic problem of moving from traditional inequalities to modern inequalities, and that's what we're noticing.
Right.
You know,
and the political
feudalism,
where George Bush and everybody else can say we're here for the middle class, and the middle class themselves, you know, the Reagan Democratic piece. I mean, so maybe we're asking ourselves, where this phenomenon that we already So I think that's the question that you turn back, which is, why should we, what does the experience of the United States actually portend, instead of using the criteria we have, which is very understandable, oh, we have a developing world, you know, so we're going to hive it off.
Okay, I hesitate to cut this off, so I want to. Do you want to add Noha to this point, or did you have a new point?
I'm going to add
new point.
Well,
Okay, then I just will add two more people before you one more time.
Like, there's two fingers.
Yeah, so Jagarsh and Diane, and then we'll move on to Noah. Okay.
Yes, all the points are valid. There is a bit of confusion. I would be very cautious thinking about this as the movement of traditional tomorrow. Because when you look at historical literature and the way, for example, there's this wonderful book about the taste and distinction in British 17th and 18th century emerging middle class. You know, the building hierarchies on consumption and taste is as old, almost, as social inequality. And I think it's not a question moving from old to new, but it's a question of how you mix those two things, right? So I think that it will be a society like India where consumption and taste plays much more important role than Denmark, you know, or Norway, where you have good sort of, you know, Calvinists, which do not pay, you know, don't like to show consumption. So it's not, you know, historical thing. It's there are mixes depending on historical context.
Just really quickly, if you have to throw into the mix, what strikes, I mean, I agree with everybody that we're thinking about these transitions from old to new, whether it's in identity or relationships. I like very much thinking about, you know, feudal versus modern. But it strikes me that we could, this conversation would be enriched if we talk about conflict rather than transition. Because I think that what we're talking about is struggling over the terms of that transition. And I think that in both of these, I actually do want to come, I think thinking about the other way, the narrow, the distance in economic and the social, you know, closeness, if we think, we want to think about how those two are in tension, not just the tension about the move from old identities to new, but the, as the social distance is going in one direction, if the economic is going in another, there's conflict over that. And
but if you use marriage, it isn't. That's what we're
talking about.
Wait a minute,
but I'm talking about domestic labor and their employers. I'm not bringing gender in, all we can do that. And
that's,
I think that's
where I'm talking about social institutions. That's what I'm putting it. We actually measure, we will not say that it is getting socially closer and economically. What we know is there's greater and greater economic lobbying. So as the inequality grows on the income side, the inequality grows on the family side. So that's
okay.
The, you know,
okay,
that's
okay.
The
well, I'm talking about the level of the household here, not society at large. Although the changes in the level of the household say something about the economic changes. So as this relationship of domestic employers and laborers changes, that there's a financial relationship. It's changing the financial relationship. It's changing the security of the employees and not just the employers. It's changing the relationship of production and consumption in that household. So that's an economic relationship, but it's also changing the social relationship, which is the kind of efforts, and they're not necessarily going in the same direction in terms of the distance. That's why I thought Atul's point is important, that there might be more economic opportunity that comes with this social, you know, with those changing social relationships for domestic laborers as well. So I do think that the bottom point, my bottom line here, is to think about this as a constant, not as a smooth transition. And that we haven't really talked about that as a constant yet, but that is really what politics is going to be about, and maybe what domestic, the body politics inside the household will be about, the conflict between these two parties to that relationship.
Okay, let's just bring in the last two people who've been waiting patiently, and then you guys can finish up with some responses. No, yeah,
I
thank you.
I need to cool off this great discussion here, but I'll do it nonetheless. two points, very, very good points to Raka. Raka, see you on the issue of the domestic, if you look at your formula from the domesticity side that Diane was bringing up earlier, let me self-project from the middle-income countries of the Middle East. The domesticity itself is going through a lot of dynamic transformation, not only the middle class employees, but the domesticity
itself.
Rural people used to be the bedrock of domestic servants in the middle-income countries of the Middle East. anymore because the Hoover families are better off than they were 30 years ago, 20 years ago. So they don't send their children to the cities anymore. So that takes away one element of the circuitry, mm-hmm. just to look natural to the middle class, because this is the peasant class mm-hmm. coming to the city. You have a dynamic in the domesticity phenomenon between the educated and the non-educated urban poor. Most of them seeking domestic work. But the attitude towards the servitude is very different. I have a primary education. The other one doesn't. When I come into the household, as somebody with a primary education, I expect to be treated differently. So if you look at it from the other perspective, you might come up with a lot more interesting dynamic. The other dynamic that's interesting very quickly is gender dynamic. For the longest history of servitude in the middle income countries of the Arab world, women were the servants. Now, because of the high unemployment rate, men are coming.
That's very interesting.
Women, right? Mm-hmm. So, I encourage you to look at it from
the perspective.
Going to the political education, which always fascinates me, of course, about this whole thing, I'd like to encourage you to dwell a little bit on the rights based dimension of middle class discourse. I throw a very provocative statement at you, and admit this as well. That is, the middle class is actually coming. Really look at it, they're more concerned about their fight with the upper class than they are with their services to the lower class. They're not the avant-garde of the lower class, trying to get the lower class up. They are actually very much focused in their discursive politics nowadays with those whom they think don't deserve that much more than they are, because we are both educated, we are both da-da-da-da-da. But this upper class has so much concentration of power, political and economic, their fight is up there, not down there. Which takes me to Gates about Zuma is actually of the people, as opposed to Mbeki and Mandela, who struggled for the people, but on behalf of the people. And we are suddenly struck, and I say by meaning United Nations organizations like mine, struggling for democratic governance, oh my goodness, we're struggling with somebody coming from the people to talk about the people and maybe act also for the people, but he is of the people. This is really new. Really new. The middle class has often acted not in that way. So I think this is an important distinction about Zuma's particular. And finally, you mentioned education being an important cost that can take you out of the middle class status. Newly joined it. And you mentioned the contractual relationships in the new middle class of South Africa. I'd also like to add health costs to that and ask you a little bit about South African policies on social protection on the health side, because as we know from the data, it's the health cost that can make you drop out of the drop back into poverty. And I do.
Okay. And okay, so we have a couple of minutes left, 5 to be exact. So maybe if you could just each take 2.5-ish minutes, and we would end up on time. Why don't you start, Gay?
Good. So quickly to that. So, you know, health in South Africa, one of the huge insecurities for the African middle class right now is the AIDS crisis. And, you know, getting access to antiretrovirals is really major, and it's one of the reasons why there's been so much conflict within the ANC over Mbeki's health policies. And actually, you know, Zuma's rise to power is partly because of the conflicts over health policy and Mbeki's denialism, which is completely wacky and weird. I actually think Zuma is seen as being a man of the people much more than he actually is of the people. And I think people should be, he's no more of a populist than many of the people, than Evo Morales, of men of the people. And so I think we should be careful with what he claims and what he is, because his past, the policies that he acted as minister before were no more pro-poor than anything Mbeki's done. And I think we shouldn't be misled by the rhetoric. But I think why people support him is because of the rhetoric, because he speaks to people who don't feel they've gotten a foot in the new South Africa. And it's very powerful and very hard for people who have gotten a foot in those formerly white suburbs, very hard for them to challenge that rhetoric, because that was the rhetoric that they were part of the anti-apartheid struggle, and it's very fraught. I think that was it.
Okay.
I'm sure there was more I was supposed to respond to, but I can't remember what it was. This has been a really interesting conversation.
Yeah.
I want to just sort of address two things that Atul said. The first is Atul, is clarification. When I said I was going to talk about the home, I'm not saying it's not the private sphere. It is the private sphere. It is absolutely the private sphere. But I'm saying that just because it's the private sphere doesn't mean there's not a politics in it. There's a politics of inequality and unequal power in it that we don't talk about enough, right? And that these politics are not divorced from the politics outside. Every sphere has its specificity. So the home has its specificity, but it also reflects and contributes to inequalities in power in the other sphere. So let me just sort of clarify that. The thing about the social distancing narrowing and the economic gap widening, we've had a very good conversation. What I would add here is, you said that it actually captured economic widening inequality, but having a domestic servant is all about inequality. The single strongest indicator of the number of paid domestic workers there is anywhere is level of inequality. When level of inequality declines, number of servants declines, or domestic workers decline anywhere. So it's fundamentally about inequality. So also I didn't obviously have time to discuss the specificity of the city that I was talking about. As you very well know, that Kolkata is a city that actually serves a vast hinterland. It's the only major city in, you know, Bihar, Orissa, Bangladesh in that sense, the rest of West Bengal also. So there's a constant supply of people being thrown off the land or coming from the land, youngest sons, oldest sons, youngest daughters, you know, there's a constant supply. The discussion that happens in Calcutta, oh, we can't find any servants anymore, is an absurdity. Because there is a constant supply, you know, and so... And unlike in Latin America, where servants come in to the cities and it's a life course thing, they start off and get a paid domestic servant worker job, but really they want to become market women, go to some other informal sector. Unlike that, they come in and they stay. It's a lifelong thing. So it's all about economic inequality. So in fact, though there's lots of the book that talks about gender, the word gender is not the title. Domesticity is. But classes as well, not gender. Yes, it is this moving of closing inequalities and widening inequalities that leads to this tension. And so I think the question Devesh asked is, what will happen with this? What we know is that there's an anxiety, right? Because economic inequality is wide, so you can get to have a paid domestic worker, but social inequality is narrowing. That distinction within the house is what causes a lot of anxiety and tension. How it will play out is yet to be seen, but there is increasing discussion around voting time, for example, especially since obviously the Communist Party didn't organize them, and I would say they fundamentally didn't organize them because they're a trade unionist party. They didn't think of domestic servants as real workers.
Right?
They opposed them. Of course, they opposed them. They said they couldn't be organized. That's what they opposed them.
I know communist parties over here specifically opposed the right of informal workers to like
the. And even then, even if they've gone to informal workers, they're still not. You know, they're using all the old arguments for why they're unorganizable, as it were. Right? So they can't oppose them anymore. But the parties that have opposed, have organized them, are the caste parties. The caste parties aren't very strong in Bengal because of the Communist Party. So there's this kind of weird, precisely because of the strength of Communist parties, the public politics of domestic workers is weaker in Bengal than it is in, say, Bombay or Bangalore or Delhi, where they are far more organized. And the only other thing I want to say is the last chapter of my book is actually about paid domestic workers in New York. Precisely because I didn't want people to think that this is some relationship that happens over there to other people in some backward place. So the last chapter is about New York, and it's about a lot of the common struggles that actually takes place when you have home as a site of labor. So that just as cultures of servitude in India draw from a certain caste tradition. Cultures of servitude in New York draw from a certain racial tradition. And indeed, over and over conversations, these issues are racialized such that you will have an employer saying to me, well, you know, I have to choose between a Latina and a woman from the Caribbean. I mean, it's very much that kind of racialized, but Latinas are softer, they're gentler, they're better, nannies. But I don't mind if a woman from the Caribbean cleans the house. I mean, it's a very, you know, it's so all of these relationships are nested in different sorts of, I would say, cultures of servitude and racial history. So I will leave it there. I'm very actually interested, to hear about the male to female, female to male, because most of the literature only talks about women. But in India, until 1981 census, it was primarily men, male domestic workers. In the 1981 census, it becomes equal, and now it's far more female. So it's gone the other way. So it's actually really interesting to think about your sort of relationships.
Finally, Gay has...
Well, I just remembered one thing that Deborah said that I just wanted to... I'm not sure. I just want to respond to it. I'm not sure that you can look at middle class, the sort of histories of the middle class in early industrializers as a way to think about it now, because of the point that Patrick made this morning, that I think the character of economies is changing enough. And you know, if entry into the middle class requires educational credentials, which I think this is partly how you a question of how you define the middle class. So in Diane's definition, it doesn't matter. In my definition, it would. But you know, if educational credentials matter, then it's a very different. The middle class is going to look different, and the process of it getting there is different, and it's closed off at different points in the life course in ways that are going to really matter for how people think about it politically. So I
would say that maybe the next speaker, someone will be illustrated as you move forward in this project. I think that conceptually, in terms of power and building blocks of social theory, power, authority, domination, subordination, equality, you know, we can look at the 9th century, the 8th century, the 10th, I mean, at that level of abstraction, if you want to look at something that's much more contextualized, I remain very unsatisfied with this casual way about middle class this, middle class that. You can find it this way, you can find it that way. You know, I say, well, then where does it add up? If we all can divide, each of us decides this is going to be our middle class, this is the middle class, then I think the larger project is constrained. So I don't disagree with what you said, but so I think specific, there's an aspect of a scarce educational resource knowledge, let's say. We can go back very, very far about experts, right? That's what we're going to talk about, expert knowledge. Is it about bows and arrows? Is it about just, you know, making copper? I mean, I just think that...
But we could be talking about credentials and distinction. And sort of cultural capital, which would be different than bows and arrows.
Exactly. But I'm going to push you to talk on that. You know what I'm saying? I want you to say we're not going to settle for just expert knowledge and generalize across cultures, across centuries, etc. We want to take something much more historically bounded, so that we really can talk about something that's in the place of modern educational, the university. Right, but there haven't always been universities that have always. So then, you know what I'm saying? That's what I'm struggling with, is I just read the papers and I try to figure out what I'm going to do next. Like, what's that? What are you saying? To get us more talking, that's why I was glad when we started to talk and intervene, because we're supposed to do a stable kind of thing. For us, this is a really interesting game. Overall, we see that the political struggles, conflicts, things, and it is about that. There's never enough. But I...